Agriculture and Veterans Policy Committee will come to order. As we start out, we have a new member, and I don't know where my new member
She's
is.
She's on the phone out in the hall.
She'll be coming.
Yeah.
Then we also have a new committee page, Charlie Thanks, Bruce. Charlie, you want anything, ask Charlie. Now, another note and a word of caution. These mics are live. So if you sit back there and cuss the chair, he can get a recording of that.
Mr. Chairman, I would never do that.
Didn't somebody would. Just be careful what you say between us, because it does pick it up on the thing. Well, we'll start right in. Commissioner Hugesson, you want to step forward, and today we're going to talk about Minnesota biofuels, how that's going. So, Mr. Hugesson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Gene Hugesson, Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I just came this afternoon in from Redwood Falls. I was out at the Corn and Soybean Expo that's going on out there. And not surprisingly, obviously, this is an issue that's very important to the producers of Minnesota. And so they're actually meeting there talking about some of these very same things as well. Members, what I'll do is I'll maybe run through this sort of by section. I see, according to the agenda, maybe I'll cover the biodiesel part first, and then if there's any questions, we can take some questions on that before moving on to the other section that is listed in the agenda. Members, I think, are aware that the legislature, of course, passed and the governor signed a provision here not too long ago where we would move our requirement for biodiesel from the current 2% incrementally up to 20%. The first phase of that will take place this May 1st when we go from 2% to 5%. In preparation for that, of course, there were some requirements that needed to take place. One of the things, though, I should maybe just point out is that as it relates to the biodiesel industry in the state of Minnesota, I think most members are aware that we have three plants with a capacity production of 63 million gallons. You're also aware that, of course, the current economic situation has caused some real angst among the biodiesel production system as, of course, ethanol has faced some things as well, too. Currently, the Brewster plant is shut down for over the weekend doing some quality issues, but they'll be back up and running, actually, I think, by tomorrow again. The plant near Albert Lea has been shut down for a while, but they're doing some remodeling right now, some retrofitting, and plan on being up and running again, too. So we should be back in a situation of producing, capable of producing the 63 million gallons that there is possible for them to do. Just so you are aware that if when we go to B5, we would need 40 million gallons of biodiesel to meet that. So currently, at our 63 million capacity, we can cover that needs from within the state. However, you also should be aware, if you not already are, that because of the distribution system that's in place, there is biodiesel that is used in Minnesota that comes from outside the state, and there's biodiesel that's produced in Minnesota that's shipped elsewhere. So it's just depending on where things are in various locations geographically, it isn't necessarily that we're using 100% biodiesel, Minnesota biodiesel, in Minnesota, just because of the distribution system being in place. I think if you remember the legislation, we ratchet up to the 5% in May 1st of 09 this year, and it's deliberately done at that time so that we're in a warm weather climate. Hopefully, we're in a warm weather climate by then. And what would do then, of course, is to take away some of that risk of making that transition at the time of the cold weather. But, of course, as you know, it gets cold in Minnesota, so we have to be preparing for that reality come next winter. With that in mind, part of the legislation directed, based on some of our recommendations that we pulled together, a cold weather task force that would examine these issues and prepare recommendations for the full biodiesel task force, obviously, in case some changes would be needed along the way. There will be a full report, written report, that will be delivered to the legislature per the legislation on February 15th. that will bring in any recommendations that the group will be coming together with at that time. Currently, there's three subcommittee groups of the biodiesel task force that are working on this issue, one dealing with production and distribution. I think you may remember that there's a caveat in the legislation that does allow for us to change the requirement if, in fact, there should be some problems in either the production or the distribution of the product as it may be needed. There's a blending subcommittee that would be dealing with how we mix the biodiesel and work it into the regular diesel fuels in a way that certainly would cause the least amount of problems and be the most effective. And then there's a handling subcommittee and dealing with how we, in fact, look at working with the product once it's put together and how it's made available. Members may recall that there is an issue, and it's referenced in the agenda here a little bit later on when it talks about the status of the cold weather blending infrastructure grants. The department was given $3 million for the next-gen grants. In the last legislative session, $300,000 of that was carved out to be used for grants to enable some construction of some blending facilities, particularly as it relates to southwest Minnesota. Recognizing that these grants may, in fact, actually go to facilities outside of Minnesota, that is in Sioux Falls, recognizing that that's where some of that biodiesel, some of the diesel that is distributed into Minnesota in the southwestern corner. We had discussions, and I'll jump ahead, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right, just to that issue and include it here when we're talking about the biodiesel. We made the information available, had some conversations with some potential interested parties, and in the end, the deadline came for the grant applications to come in, and we had no applications. There were no applications that came in for any grants for the biodiesel blending institutions or facilities that would serve that particular area. And it appears that certainly some of the economic uncertainty, some of the issues involved with just the economics that the biodiesel market finds itself in right now probably all contributed to some of this. But at this particular time, that money has sits there on use. I might just touch, of course, and I think you're all aware, that one of the challenges has been that the biodiesel, with the high cost of soybeans there for a while, it certainly became some economic problem trying to deal with producing biodiesel. And even right now, we've got a situation where I understand that the rack price for biodiesel is about $3.40 a gallon. And, of course, you see a selling of diesel fuel at the stations for about a dollar less than that. So there's certainly a gap that exists in that situation. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's a whole lot more I can say about the biodiesel part other than to say that we're working on with that cold flow issue as it moves into the February 15th report. And at that particular time, your committee, of course, will receive a copy of that report, or that's who it's directed to come to. We would, from every indication, what we're seeing is that moving from 2% to 5% will be no problem in the warmer months, and hopefully we're going to be able to address any of the issues that would apply to the winter months as well. I'll stop at this point as it relates to the biodiesel part and take any questions that you might have.
Before I take questions, I want to welcome our new senator, Senator Phoebe. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, I was out on a phone call when you started, so thank you.
You're an important
person. It's good to be here.
So answer the phone.
Thanks.
Now, Senator Dale, I believe you were first.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Hugesson, is there any biodiesel coming from animal fat, or is it all soybeans that are the source of the biodiesel?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dale, the facility in Redwood Falls, the Farmers Union facility, has a capacity of doing it with animal fats. My understanding, though, is at this particular time they're not. Now, it may be just that I don't have the correct information, but I know for a lot of the time they were not using that, but they do have the capability of using animal fats in that facility.
Well, is soybeans the only source of biodiesel in this state?
At this point, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dale, at this point, yes.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I guess, I've gotten, three complaints on, you know, the gelling thing, even at 2%, you know, but it's, you know, this time of the year. You know, I guess one of those has come from a trucker, but the other two are from passenger vehicles. I wondered if your department had encountered anything on differences between, you know, the trucking industry and having a passenger vehicle that operates on diesel fuel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, that's an issue, of course, that comes up any time in cold weather, and I would say also any time having to do with diesel fuel. Now, with the issue of biodiesel, of course, the first winter, we did have some quality issues. There's no doubt about it. For the most part, my understanding is that were those issues have been resolved. Diesel fuel in general, and I'm no expert on this because I'm in the Department of Agriculture, and this is the Department of Commerce area that they handle this particular area. But diesel fuel, just based on sudden changes in weather, can cause some problems if, in fact, there's a problem with the number one and number two not mixing correctly in the first place. And certainly there's that issue when it gets cold and something gets blamed, and biodiesel, of course, you know, is a potential problem. Now, one of the things, though, that the biodiesel plants in Minnesota have done is they've gone to a very strict quality control issue system, in the sense that they're very careful about what product actually leaves their facility. That, in fact, is part of the reason why the Brewster facility has been shut down for a few days, because they were not comfortable with the particular product that they had, and they wanted to make sure that before they sent any of this product out, and none of it did go out, that they were, in fact, in compliance with where this needed to be. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, the other issue that comes into play is that, every batch of diesel fuel that comes in could be a little bit different, and some of this biodiesel may be coming from other states that might be coming from some facilities that don't use those same quality control issues as well. So I think if you look at it over in the big picture, you'll always find some issues that'll come up with some filter plugging, with some things that are going on. If people report it, the Department of Commerce will investigate it and check it out to see if, in fact, it's, you know, all coming from a particular location, if it's coming from a particular station, or if it's if that is a situation. So my suggestion for any of you is, if you get calls on these, refer them to Weights and Measures at the Department of Commerce, and if you can't get a hold of them, let me know, and we'll see that you get in touch with the right people.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up there. Commissioner, do you know if all of the plants in Minnesota, all three of them, use an anti-gel agent in their production? Do you know that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, no, I do not.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Skye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Hugesson. I understand that on February 15th we're going to get some more information on this, and I look forward to seeing that. If when they're working on their information for cold weather on diesel fuel, my understanding is that the low sulfur diesel fuel requirement at the federal level has also contributed to the problems that we've been having with gelling and with moisture fallout and glycerin fallout on diesel fuel. If when they're preparing the information for us that we're going to receive on February 15th, if there would be somebody that could talk about that, I think it would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skye, I've heard the same thing myself, and we'll make sure that issue is addressed.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langstaff.
Mr. Chair, is it true that canola oil doesn't gel when it's made into biodiesel?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Langstaff, I know there are some different qualities with canola oil that that are certainly better than what even the soybean would have as it relates to the cold weather. Europe, of course, uses the rapeseed almost exclusively as it relates to their biodiesel production. We, of course, have looked at are there opportunities to do that with the canola oil in Minnesota, and that one of the unfortunate situations is there's not enough produced to move in that direction at this time, and, of course, the economics right now are creating some problems in moving in that direction as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Hugesson, one more thing. It's just a thought that came to mind. We're going to be required to meet federal requirements for carbon dioxide reductions in diesel fuel carbon emissions. Does biodiesel help us meet those goals?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I think it does, and but I can't give you a specific in terms of what that would really be, but that's something we could look at trying to have for you by the 15th as well, too.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Keep on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Senator Scoy, just let me back up. One of the problems with determining that is that you have different people looking at how that's measured. Do you, in fact, include what comes just from the fuel itself, or do you have to include the carbon dioxide emissions from the tractors that were used to produce that grain in the first place that goes into the production of the biodiesel? So there gets to be some disagreement in terms of how big does the parameter need to be in terms of what's determined to arrive at that particular figure.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, do you know, is anybody trying to get some handle around that?
Yes.
And the reason that I'm asking this is because I know that they're talking about putting spark, pre or after burners on tractors, and trucks are going to have urea on them to try to reduce the carbon emissions. And I'm wondering if this isn't a better way to do it, and I just don't have the information, and I don't know if anybody does, but it seems like something we should be looking at if it's helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scott, I would agree. If I could, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'll move on to talk a little bit about the ethanol situation and where we are as it relates to the E20 EPA waiver. Perhaps just as a very brief update or background in terms of where we are with the ethanol situation. We currently have 18 plants that are operating in the state of Minnesota. We have three other plants, two of which are done but not operating because they're caught up in a Chapter 11 situation with a company. And then a third plant that is not finished with construction yet as well. But the 18 plants that are up and running are producing 850 million gallons of ethanol. And if, in fact, we get to the E20 mandate as put in place by state law, we would be needing about 540 million gallons. So, again, well within what we are currently producing in the state. When this particular provision was passed in 2005, the summer afterwards, at then PCA Commissioner Cheryl Corrigan, myself, and the fellow from the governor's office, Jason Roloff, that's in D.C., went to meet with EPA at the federal level to discuss how we would go about seeking what's referred to as the EPA waiver. Because I think you're aware that before, in fact, we can move in this direction, we have to have this waiver from the EPA in the sense that right now E20 is not a legal fuel. Up to E10 is, and E85, for those vehicles that are flexible fuel capable, are legal, but E20 is not a legal fuel. And that, of course, has to be determined by EPA. So we need that waiver request in order for that, to take place. When we met with EPA back in the summer of 2005, we got what I would describe as best a polite reception. It was sort of like, oh, yes, here comes Minnesota again with some new ideas. We'll take it and we'll see what we can do. And not that they weren't cooperative and telling us some things that needed to be done. In fact, they did suggest that what we do is we put together some preliminary testing that would prove to them, as what they said, that there were no showstoppers to the kinds of things that might have to be considered, such as the durability of the engine parts on existing vehicles to be able to take E20 compared to E10. Did it affect the drivability, the acceleration? Does it have long-term engine wear that would be a problem? Would there be emissions problems that would be different with E20 than with E10? And then also even a health factor in terms of what that exhaust difference might mean to the general public as well. As a result, Minnesota, based with some of the resources that we were able to pull together, we got some help from the Corn Growers Association, from the the Great Lakes Governor's Council, a little money that we could come up, some help with the Renewable Fuels Association out of Washington, D.C., and proceeded to do some tests with the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State University Mankato. What was interesting is as these tests were going on, we still had this conversation going on back and forth with Washington, mainly with EPA, but also a bit with the Department of Energy. In the 2007 State of the Union address that President Bush gave, of course, he tossed out the challenge of a renewable fuel standard of 35 million gallons. All of a sudden, things changed. Washington started calling us, because what they came to the conclusion was is that based on current usage of and projections of usage of ethanol in the United States, they were not going to get to a 35 million gallon fuel standard without something like E20. And so suddenly there was more interest in the kinds of proposals that Minnesota was doing. And so as a result, this has been moving ahead with really good cooperation from those people at the federal level. The reports that came in from University of Minnesota and Minnesota State University Mankato this last year showed that, in fact, there were no showstoppers. However, and you should be aware that those reports were never intended to be the final determinant. It was only to just more or less do some kind of lower-cost studies that would show that there was nothing major that would preclude us moving on to some higher-priced studies that were going to be necessary. What has happened since then is that the Department of Energy, mainly, but also some things out of EPA and USDA, have put together a series of studies that I think number about 30 different studies. And this includes not only those things that I mentioned earlier, but also includes things like small engines. What is the effect of E20 on lawnmowers or snowmobiles or ATVs and those recreational vehicles, weed whackers, whatever we might be looking at. So those kinds of things have to be addressed. My understanding is that there's something like about $40 million U.S. Dollars that are being put into these studies and with varying degrees of time in terms of when they will be done. The law that Minnesota passed says like this. We can reach E20 by two different ways, either voluntarily through increased usage through E85 plus the E10, or if, in fact, that doesn't happen by 2010, that we, in fact, then go to it legislatively moving E10 up to E20. I don't think there's anyone that will even go out on a limb and say that we have any way of reaching that voluntarily with use of E85. E85, while it's a good idea, and I'll talk about that more in just a little bit here, just has not gone up and used as much as it had hoped it would be. And Minnesota has always been a bit skeptical, not in the terms of not that E85 is good, but just in terms of its acceptance. And I think history is proving that there are some challenges with that whole issue. But what we have to do is be in a position, of course, is to seek that waiver in time for us to implement a program that would allow us to meet the statutory obligation of having E20 in place by August 30th, 2013. That's the deadline that the legislation calls for. More recent federal legislation requires that EPA has to respond to a waiver request within 9 months or 270 days from the time that waiver is submitted. And so as a result, backing up in terms of that, we have to allow a nine-month period of time for that waiver request to be considered and either given a thumbs up or thumbs down by EPA. We would hope that perhaps as early as sometime in 2010, we can move ahead with that waiver request and submit that to Washington and get an answer back from EPA in a way that would be acceptable for what we would like to do. One of the more difficult aspects of this, of course, is putting a definite conclusion time to when these various studies will be done, because there's always factors that come into play that don't let them take place when people think they're going to be when it's going to happen. And so as a result, some of them take longer than they should. Perhaps the most encouraging piece of news I heard was in November when I heard current USDA Secretary Ed Schaefer speak at a renewable fuels conference, when he said that he just had previously to that had a conversation with EPA Administrator Johnson, and Mr. Johnson told Secretary Schaefer that in his estimation, EPA was within 12 to 18 months of being able to grant an E20 waiver. Now, if that is the case, that would, in fact, be very promising in terms of falling into the timeline that we're looking at here as well also. So with that in mind, just so that you are aware, and incidentally, there is a a written report that's coming to you also, in this case, January 15th, having to do with the E-20 waiver, so that you get some of the details that I've just explained here and perhaps some more specific kinds of things that would be involved with that as well. Mr. Chairman, I guess I would stop at this point and see if there are any questions from members before I move on to E85.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, does the E-20 blend have a – are there more severe constraints on the condensation issue that sometimes is present in the current blend of fuel? Is this going to be a problem that is exacerbated by cold weather if we go to an E-20 fuel?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, that's one of the things that, that of course, the testing is looking at, doing that sort of thing on a basis perhaps larger than just what we did on a somewhat limited test here in the course of 1 year. Part of the test was the University of Minnesota had some drivers, professional drivers, actually testing vehicles and taking reports four different times a year to gauge the various reaction of that fuel at any one time. I don't know that there's enough that's known yet at this point to really give a definitive answer. One of the interesting things that came out of has come out of the study so far, and somewhat of a bit of a surprise, is that the fuel efficiency is actually higher with E20 than it is with E10. You get a better conversion factor with a little bit higher amounts than you do with than even at E10. So there, I think some of this other testing will have some promising parts to it as well. The testing, that, for instance, that they're doing is being done at some federal labs. It's done at some universities, some different parts of the country that where this testing is going on by the various entities that are funding it.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Hugesson, what is the difference then between E20 and E10 in terms of mileage?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dale, I don't recall the exact amount, but it was enough higher so that it was noticed, and it was and again keep in mind that none of the reports have listed this in the reports simply because they didn't feel comfortable that they had enough specific test data put together to gauge it in a way that we could use as a definitive argument definitive conclusion as to what the difference might be. But it was, and maybe the best way to say is that it was just, it's anecdotally noted that it does appear to be higher at the E20 than it was at a lower rate.
Any other questions? Chaudhry, Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, we're in reference to the discussion about moving towards a mandate towards E20, will the department have definitive information on some of these questions that were just asked regarding efficiency, emissions, and costs before it proposes a mandate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, yes, and in fact, the mandate will take effect on August 30th, 2013, if, in fact, EPA is granted the waiver. And there are a few other things that we have the ability to look at, too, such as the availability, the pricing situation, and so forth. So there are those things. And it's not the Department of Ag that will do this on its own. We have to work with the Department of Commerce because they handle the blending types of things. We work with PCA because of the environmental issues on that. So all those things will come into play. Also, from EPA standpoint, they will be looking at these issues as well because they fully recognize that the decision that EPA makes at the Washington level will have to stand up to court challenges, literally, from various perhaps various entities throughout the country, be it automobile manufacturers who are concerned about warranties, whether it be environmental groups that are looking at it from an environmental standpoint. So they're not going to be moving in that direction, even granting the waiver, without those things being considered at the federal level as well.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, certainly those are all considerations, and you're only able to speak on behalf of the Department of Minnesota Agriculture. So just from the perspective of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, will it require definitive information on efficiency, emissions, and cost differences regarding E20 before it itself as a department supports a mandate towards E20?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Chaudhry, I'd have to go back and check the legislation for sure. I am not real comfortable giving you a definitive answer on that in terms of how much ability I have to, on behalf of the department, to make some of those calls. So some of those things are beyond just me in terms of where that might be. Obviously, we will have the information. Keep in mind that I think any of us would be reluctant to move ahead with something like this if, in fact, we felt the efficiency was less than where it would be with E10. So those kinds of things, I think, would be rather obvious that we would want to feel comfortable that we're moving in the correct direction in that whole situation. So I think it's fair to say that, yes, we would want to make sure that we are moving in that direction before we would support before we'd want to encourage that we move ahead with that without making some kind of a change legislatively or whatever else might be needed.
Any other questions?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members, if I might, I'll just touch briefly on some of the E85 situations that we've got going on in Minnesota. E85 is, of course, 85%, up to 85% ethanol and 15% regular fuel. And it's used only, of course, in the flex fuel vehicles. And while it's been widely pushed around various parts of the country as a real means of moving towards more usage of renewable fuels, there's been a real dilemma in terms of getting it to catch on. And part of that problem has been, of course, with the issue of which do you need first? Do you need the vehicles that can use it, or do you need the stations that can provide the fuel for it? And the automobile manufacturers say, we'll build more if there's more stations, and the stations say, we'll build more, have more stations if there's more vehicles. And so we're kind of caught in this catch-22 situation. Minnesota, by far and away, is way out front on this, on the E85. We, thanks to the legislature and the things that we have done in this, we have more stations here than any place else. We have 350 stations, I think, out of about a little over 2,000 nationally, so it's, you know, we've got a very large percentage. Yet in Minnesota, we use, if my calculations are right, we use about 2.7 billion gallons of fuel, gasoline, in a year. We're using about 21 million gallons of E85, so it's really quite a small percentage. And yet the E85 used in Minnesota is about 15% to 20% of all the 85 used in the whole United States. So we are still, you know, way out front with where a lot of other places are. And as we move ahead in this direction, of course, it'll be interesting to see how this does work out. Now, one of the things that you may be aware that's happening is that there has started to be the installation of some blender pumps. And the blender pumps are the ability for people to use E85 or E50 or E30 or some blend other than just the E85. Now, the legality of this, of course, is that you're only supposed to use it in a vehicle that's capable of using a flex fuel. Some people would say that at E85 they're not getting the fuel efficiency they like, but at E50 they get, you know, it's much better, or E30 or something like that. I don't think it's any secret that you've got also people that are using blender pumps in their regular vehicles and maybe at an E20 or an E30. And not having any trouble, even with some older vehicles. So that certainly is occurring also, but, of course, legally it's not supposed to be happening. But overall, in terms of where E85 is going to go, I am less than optimistic that it is going to be the national way of achieving the renewable fuel standard. I think it's certainly an option. And we've always seen it as one option to present to people. It does make a lot of sense to move in that direction. But short of doing something like Brazil, which requires all their new vehicles to be capable of, burning a higher blend of fuel. In fact, Brazil burns between 20 and 26% ethanol based on the market conditions at any given time. We're kind of stuck with moving in the situation that we are right here. So that's, basically what the situation is with the E85 at this point.
Any questions? Senator Chaudhry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. There's one thing I thought I noticed, and this was a question I had because you follow the numbers closer than me. When regular gas prices were upwards of $4 a gallon, there was a greater difference between regular unleaded gas and the price of ethanol than when regular unleaded gas was, at a lower price. Mm-hmm. Prices we're used to, there's about a 40% difference. But I thought I understood that in some areas, and maybe it's all areas, E85 was upwards of a dollar less than regular unleaded gas during the height of the gas prices. First of all, I guess the first question is that something you can confirm, and do you know the extent of that, or was that just isolated incidents?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, no, in fact, that is the case. It's a fact that the fuel efficiency of E85 is not as good as E10 or certainly even E0. The sort of the benchmark I have heard is that E85 needs to be about 40 cents less for it to be a kind of a comparable wash in terms of the fuel efficiency versus the cheaper price that you're getting for the E85. When we started to see fuel prices go higher at the pump, in fact, yes, I was seeing more common to see 60 cents difference between E85 and E10. And it was quite simply the fact that ethanol was being produced more cheaply than what the producers were able to buy crude oil or refined oil from the oil companies. The station in my hometown, one of the stations in my hometown, was selling it for $1.05 difference for a while. And all of that depended on where the stations were getting their product, who they were getting from, what the price, what they were being charged, and so forth. And, I'm sure someone were probably making a little more money with the E85 at any given time because of the ability to do that. So that sort of thing, does take place. If you look at what's going on right now, though, you see that sometimes E85 is priced only a few cents, so maybe 20 cents less in some, but maybe even less than that, because of right now the ethanol prices are higher than what it would be if you were doing an E10. One of the real dilemmas that the ethanol plants have gone through is that they obviously had a time of some good profitability. When oil prices were high, they were getting more money for their ethanol. And then all of a sudden, of course, things started to go down. Well, what happened was that the ethanol plants that were buying corn for maybe $7, $8 a bushel had some dilemmas because that was not profitable. So corn dropped to $6. A bunch of them bought up corn because that seemed like a bargain compared to $8, only to find out that corn went lower yet. And so it got down to, $4 or less than that, actually about $3.50 a bushel where it's been until just recently. Then with the national economy going in the tank and the demand for fuel going down, oil prices going down to where they are now at the stations, you've got a situation where ethanol prices are at the rack about the same as what it is for E10, but the ethanol plants that are having to still maybe process $6 corn and sell it for $1.40 or $1.70 at the other end are not doing real well. So you've got all these market conditions that are coming into play here, creating some real issues for a lot of people. I know this isn't necessarily part of what we're talking about here, but you know, one of my real concerns as we look at all this is that you know, as when oil prices are low, people say, well, do we really need a renewable fuels program? But the reality is, part of the reason we're in the dilemma we are nationally now is because oil prices were so high, and it caused just a real problem with the whole economy that we're having to deal with at this point. Whereas if, in fact, the United States had had an aggressive renewable fuels program for a number of years in the past, we maybe wouldn't be in some of the problem that we are right now. So editorial comment, I hope that the U.S. does not back away at least completely from where we need to be in terms of having a viable renewable fuels program.
Just follow up, Mr. Andre. Chair.
So, Commissioner, that's precisely my question. It seems to me that when there was that point in time where there was upwards of $1 and $1.05 difference between regular unleaded and E85, wasn't that kind of the ultimate test as to whether market conditions would allow E85 to take off? Because at a dollar difference, you suddenly are way beyond efficiency concerns, and it really is then becomes quite worth it to use E85. And just a cost sense. And you know, all emissions concerns aside, it just seems to be cheaper than between the actual price and efficiency to use that. But it didn't. It would have seemed intuitive that E85 sales would have surged, to really taken off, given that difference. And that was the prime opportunity for E85 to really, really make its mark. But I don't understand. I don't seem to understand that it did. So what do we do if we've overcome, if there was a point in time where those cost concerns were clearly overcome and it still didn't take off? What is really going on then with E85?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, explained the dilemma that we've got, because there should have been a huge surge in the use of E85 at that particular time. And there was an increase, but not what that should have been based on what the price. When you query people as to why not, it comes back to this issue of convenience, habit, doing the things the way I've done. My station doesn't carry E85. I'm not going to drive 10 blocks someplace to get it, unless you know you're really a diehard advocate of terms of wanting either to promote the ethanol industry or look at something that's more fuel efficient. It was kind of a strange dilemma that people were paying over $4 a gallon for gasoline and not complaining any more than they were in the first place. That part puzzled me and still does, why people were willing to pay that amount of money as long as they had the amount of money to do it with. There's no good explanation other than that what I've been able to determine is just the fact that people are not used to having to go for the particular product to someplace other than what they're normally used to having it. If, in fact, their station carried it, they used it. And if they didn't, they weren't going to. And granted, some places there's a better distribution of D85 stations than others. When you look at where we are with 350 stations, I think that's still less than, well, probably about only 15% of our stations that are, maybe 20% of the stations that have E85. So that's not a very high amount, and they're not necessarily dispersed real evenly geographically either.
Just last question, so Mr. Chair and Commissioner, would the department be able to provide information on sales of E85 during the height of regular unleaded prices, as a percentage, or you know, of the E85 stations that exist? Would it be able to provide information on what increase there was, if at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, we don't have that, but I think we can get it from the Department of Commerce.
Thank you.
And we'll see that you get it.
Thank you.
Commissioner Rope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner and Senator Chaudhry, to your point, to your question about why didn't we see a big uptick in use of E85 when there's a big price differential, I just would offer an anecdotal experience that happened to me at the pump, happened to me filling up about the time. I think a lot of this goes to marketing and general misunderstanding in the public. You know, I think they see the E85 stickers, and they don't know what it means. They don't know if they can put it in their car. And I overheard a conversation on the other side of the pump as I was filling up one day, and it was exactly that kind of conversation. It's like, man, look at the price difference between these different kinds of gasoline. Can we put this in? No, I don't think we could put that in our car. That's going to kill your engine. Or, you know, people don't know that they can put it in or not, or if you have to have a flex fuel car, or if you can put it in a regular car. So I think marketing and just general understanding amongst the public really explains a lot of that. It is a huge price difference, and why wouldn't people go to that except they don't understand? So I just offer that as an anecdotal piece, but I think it's very telling.
Well, members, I've had the pleasure of going to different states and different conferences, and the rest of the states are very jealous of how Minnesota has moved ahead in this field. And they said, well, how'd you do that? Because we mandated. Nobody likes mandates, but that's what happened, and that's why we moved ahead. But forget about, even if it does cost, look what it does to our climate, to our environment. That's the key to it, I think.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think you're aware that, you know, none of this would be accomplished without good coalitions. And certainly there have been a lot of people that have worked together on this very aggressively. And we've been fortunate to have the Minnesota branch of the American Lung Association be very aggressive in this area as well. And that's been certainly a real key factor in terms of why we've been able to, I think, be out ahead of where a lot of states has been, too. And it simply goes back to what the chair mentioned, is that they recognize the environmental benefits and what that does for the human body in that environment. And it's a good team effort to accomplish what we have been able to accomplish.
I think, members, also this is a learning process. I guess I'll use those words. The more we move along, the more people will use E85. I think, and of course, I think blender pumps myself, I think, are one of the best things. So you can kind of do what you want. Senator, I mean, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, just to touch on the next-gen energy grants, you may be aware that, of course, Minnesota, in its wisdom, has said that while renewable fuels from corn and soybeans is good, we have to look beyond that for many reasons. And so for that reason, we've been very aggressive with the next-generation approach. The governor's recommendation a few years ago was that we create this entity, and Senator Bickerman is part of that board, as well as other senators, representatives, and some people from the private industry, as well as state agencies. And so this group has worked over the last couple years in terms of the kinds of things that we could be doing to move in the direction of where we're going to go with next generation production of a renewable fuel source. And certainly with that in mind, of course, the cellulosic approach, biomass materials are very important. We've seen Minnesota move ahead with this idea that while we maybe aren't in the position yet to produce things from cellulose, we certainly can use some of our biomass material to help produce existing type of ethanol by replacing some of the natural gas that's used to fuel these plants. And so we've got some things going on in that area even as we speak. But our goal is to get to the point where, in fact, we do have a cellulosic plant up and running in Minnesota. With that in mind, the legislature gave the Department of Agriculture $3 million here a couple years ago to be using towards doing some grants to incentivize in going in that direction. As I mentioned earlier, $300,000 was carved out of that to use for that the blending plants in southwestern Minnesota or wherever it might be needed, but it did not get used. But with the remaining $2.7 million, the department took applications, went through a kind of a screening process in terms of where those grants might be awarded, and then in the process, I brought back to the NextGen board for their input and some suggestions, and they gave us some good advice in terms of these things. And in the end, we in fact did award that $2.7 million this last year to these facilities. And Mr. Chair, maybe members, I'll just quickly run through just kind of a couple of the ideas where this is going. But there's a Central Minnesota Ethanol Partnership that's in the Little Falls area that is actually a out-of-country plant that's going to come into Minnesota and partner with the ethanol plant there to burn cellulose using wood waste products. And so the largest grant of $910,000 went to that facility, and they're moving ahead with creating that what would be probably the first commercial-scale cellulosic facility in Minnesota that would be there then in Little Falls. It's working together with a company called SunOpta, which has its headquarters actually in Canada, but they have a Minnesota subsidiary here, which is a fully up-and-running entity, which will be running this this facility. The existing ethanol plant at Benson received $700,000 because they likewise are moving to a biomass material in their facility. In fact, this last year they did some experimentation with collecting corn cobs from the corn production and how they're going to, in fact, move in the direction of handling the biomass. I've been on the site, as I think some others of you have, and seen they have a facility built in which they're going to be using to move in that direction. And ultimately, of course, the goal is to actually make ethanol out of that product. We awarded $220,000 to a hog farmer in southeastern Minnesota for a pork methane digester facility. This is an area that has not been economically feasible for. There's some new technology that's available that's come from out east, Michigan, Ohio, someplace in that area. This will be the first one that is done in Minnesota, and we'll have an opportunity to move in that direction. I think you're aware that Minnesota does have a large pork production in this state, and the ability to use some of that animal waste to make methane gas certainly offers some unique opportunities down the road. The Northern Excellence Seeds facility up in Williams, Minnesota, northern Minnesota, gets $200,000 because they're going to look at doing some burning some waste biomass in with the grasses to produce electricity in that area. There is a Minnesota Valley alfalfa producers in Raymond that gets $400,000 that is looking at some biomass to energy technology to transport various raw materials, including crop waste, grasses, wood products, and so forth. That is over in the western Minnesota. Then there were three different grants given to educational entities, the University of Minnesota, Department of Forestry, Central Lakes Ag College, Lakes College in Wadena, and then also the University of Minnesota Morris that got some for some of the research kinds of things that they're doing in these areas as well. It's interesting how it worked out. We had a goal of trying to disperse this in somewhat of a geographic equality area, and without even really trying it, it ended up working that way. We've got some different types of facilities that were funded in this. We recognize these are not big dollars, but I think it's what we're saying is that Minnesota's committed to move ahead with this program. Granted, we're going to have some real economic challenges in this next biennium, we know, in terms of what we might be doing for the future. But we're still looking at supporting some of these efforts in any way that we can and see if there's ways that we can leverage some dollars to move in that direction. The NextGen board goes into sort of a recess during the legislative session, but once the session is over, that board will be back in operation and looking at some new ideas as well. Mr. Chairman, I can answer any questions that you might have in that area or anything else in general. Otherwise, that more or less completes my report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I have a question on the NextGen grants. At the end of the process, do each of these places provide a report, and then do we hear back? Because I would imagine we're trying to get little incubation projects around the state, and how do we know what's working and what's not working and the next big thing for us to be investing in?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator. That's a very good question, and I'm glad to elaborate on it because that's exactly what we were looking at. We went through a contract process with each of the grant awardees, and including in that contract that involved some of the obligations that the awardee would have to meet One of these, of course, would be, yes, providing a report of this. One of the other things had to be is that they would be willing to host some visitors to come and see what, in fact, did take place and to more or less report back to the state how that investment went. Did it pay off? Did it not? Or the things that were good, not? And we, you know, without being what I would call real aggressive on this, but we've got some leverage in there that, you know, that they have to perform some of these things in order for them to get the very last dollar that they're going to be able to achieve. But to my knowledge, all the contracts are signed with all of these entities, and so we will have information back from these, and we will at least annually report on the progress of where these demonstration projects are going.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hugeson, Commissioner Hugeson, I wonder if you give us any sense as to where the price of soybeans has to be to make this all work out economically. And I know we got the soybean meal and we got all these other factors that kind of play into it, but at $3.40 a gallon rack price for biodiesel, which is soybean oil, and I don't know what the price of soybean meal is right now, but can you give us any sense of where we've got to be on the price of soybeans to make this all work out and be competitive, price competitive?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, again, though, that totally depends on what the price of oil is at any given time, because the price of oil more or less determines what's going to be the factor for not only producing the soy diesel or an ethanol, whatever be the case, but certainly what they're able to achieve at being able to sell that product on the other end too. I'm not in a position to answer that, and I think probably the more specific would be better to ask actual people from the plants themselves.
Any other questions? None. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I would just encourage any of you that have any questions on any of this or anything else that comes up along the way, please let us know, because we don't need to wait for another hearing. We'd be glad to either provide you individually with answers or put you in touch with somebody that does. Many ways we're sort of just the conduit for getting you in touch with the people that would have the answers that you might need along this. So. Again, I want to thank the committee. You've been very supportive in terms of what Minnesota has tried to do in this area. And as Senator Vickerman mentioned, we're still held in envy by many of our counterparts in other parts of the country because of what we have been able to achieve. And I would also contend that a lot of what else has gone on in the country wouldn't have happened if Minnesota wouldn't have done what we did, because we more or less proved that it could be done, that there was a reason to do it. And unfortunately, the rest of the country just didn't catch on as quickly as we did. And we would have had some of the problems that we've had even over the last year as it relates to some of the economy problems. So thank you very much.
Now we'll move into overview of the ARI research on biofuels. If they will come forward, and that would be Catherine Paris. She's Planning and Project Development Director. Michael Sparby, Senior Project Development Director. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Paris. I'm with the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, and joining me today is Michael Sparby, Senior Development Director for AURI. We're appreciative to be here today. Thank you so much for inviting us here, and we're excited to talk to you about the research that we've been doing and the work we've been doing. Coming around right now is the latest copy of our quarterly newsletter. That gives you a kind of broader sense of what AURI is doing right now. Today, our presentation will focus specifically on the work we're doing with liquid biofuels, ethanol and biodiesel. Project development work at AURI takes on two forms. The first is client-directed projects. This is when we're specifically paired with a startup or existing enterprise working on their value-added agriculture venture. We provide due diligence, feasibility, and technical assistance to our clients. Additionally, URI is working on broad impact initiatives. In these initiatives, we're focused on identifying emerging opportunities with the potential to have large impact on a significant number of producers and using a large amount of commodities. Our broad impact initiatives are industry-driven and public information. In relation to biofuels work, AURI provides to its clients quality assurance and feasibility analysis. Additionally, to help make plants as economically successful as possible, we are working to develop new uses for the co-products associated with biofuels processing and working to decrease the usage of fossil fuels at existing biofuels plants. AUR has also worked on the next generation of biofuels and is working to help develop the expert networks necessary to support the biofuels industry.
Mr. Chair, members, my name for the record is Michael Sparby. I'm a senior project development director for AURI. To talk a little bit about the biofuels, we're going to break it into certain areas of biodiesel first and then take a look at the work that we're doing in ethanol. In the biodiesel area, taking a look at all of the plants that have started up in the state, we assisted them in their startup procedures to make sure that they met the ASTM standards. And we also did support the industry when the industry was dealing with the challenges pertaining to the cold weather or low temperature handling of the biodiesel. And we did that through our facility in Marshall, Minnesota. We also, in collaboration with the Minnesota soybean growers, put together a how-to handbook for producer groups, commodity groups, not necessarily commodity groups, but co-ops and individuals that were interested in taking a look at putting up a biodiesel plant. And this information essentially helped them answer questions to tell them whether or not this is going to be a good idea for them in their specific scenario or their area. The last one that we have on here was an interesting collaboration. We collaborated with the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. We also collaborated with the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Got together with Articat, which is a recreational vehicle manufacturing facility in northwestern Minnesota. And at that time, they were producing a diesel ATV. It was one of the first ones that they had produced. And what we worked with them is that they tested in their pre-production testing three units that were run off of a B20 blend alongside these six other units that they were running through with regular diesel fuel. And what we ended up finding out of that project is that the three units performed equal to and in some cases even better than the other six production units. And the outcome of that project was a certification of B20 for these diesel ATVs, which actually became biodiesel ATVs with the B20 recommendation certification. Along with biodiesel, when you're producing biodiesel, one of the co-products or byproducts out of that process is glycerin. One of the things that we like to say within AURI is that clients will come to us with a waste product, and when they leave the labs, they walk out with a co-product. Something is more of use for them. And a couple of examples of that is the Farmers Union Industry Glycerin Performance on Pelleting. And essentially what that was taking a look at mixing feather meal and glycerin together and pelletizing that. What that did is it increased the feed energy value of that pellet or of that feed, and it also allowed for greater product distribution, meaning the densification of that meal They were able to transport that further and open up additional markets for them. A second one dealing with glycerin is one that we're leveraging with some federal Department of Energy dollars, taking a look at displacing corn in half starter rations. So if you take a look at the energy value of corn and the energy value of the glycerin, we're seeing if we can't displace some corn within those rations to be able to achieve kind of a low-cost ration for producers. So we switch over into the byproducts of the ethanol process, essentially three categories that we're looking at here. The first one is ash, which is actually kind of new to the state in the sense that we do have ethanol facilities that are both doing gasification, such as Little Falls, as well as Benson or CVAC, Chippewa Valley and Benson. And we also have Corn Plus that is combusting corn solubles or the syrups, and that produces an ash, which is a byproduct or co-product out of that. The ash does have fertilizer value, but one of the difficulties that they ran into is how to apply that ash as a fertilizer onto the fields, in the sense that this product is really a powdery type product. It was extremely difficult to handle. So we worked with collaboration with the university and with some private industries within the state to take a look at how can we densify that ash material and really come up with something that's equivalent or usable within current handling equipment. We're in the process. We've done the polymerization, making granules. We've done the densification work with that one. And right now we're looking at actual field tests to see what the agronomic uptake of those nutrients within those plants is, so we can get that information out. The second co-product coming out of the ethanol industry is distiller's dried grains with solubles, or DDGS. And I'm not going to go through every single one that we've got currently with DDGs, but we do have seven projects that are mainly looking at livestock diets, and those range from dairy to cattle to swine diets, and how to increase the inclusion rates within those diets or increase the feeding rates of DDGs within the livestock sector. And we've also, through our Waseca laboratory, have projects taking a look at mixing DDGs within pellet formulations. Formulations are actually going into feed as well as formulations for heating-type applications. The third one, the syrup or the solubles, which is essentially the liquid part that comes out of the starch fermentation process within the ethanol. We've worked with a number of plants, one in specifically that I'll get to here in a bit, but to take a look at digesting those solubles or those syrups to generate methane gas, and then that gas would then go on to displace natural gas in the ethanol process. And we're also taking a look at utilizing solubles in swine diets. Interesting project. The difficulty is swine systems aren't necessarily set up to handle a liquid feed, but we do have facilities within the state that are set up to do that, and we're looking at being able to do the testing with them to at least get some preliminary data and see how much of a differentiation and how much of a cost difference there could be with that. A lot of focus for the ethanol industry as well as the biodiesel industry is how can they reduce their usage of fossil fuels. If you take a look at the work that CVAC has done down at Chippewa Valley Ethanol Co-op, We assisted with them with their initial gasification or gasifier feasibility analysis that has then led to the construction of that gasification unit. And also, as Commissioner Hugeson had alluded to, the corn cob collection. We did participate in a joint project with West Central Research and Outreach Center out of Morris, Minnesota, the ARS Federal Laboratory, also located in Morris, the Minnesota Corn Growers, CVAC, and the Minnesota Department of Commerce in a corn cob collection demonstration where we had two different types of equipment that harvested about 5,000 acres of corn cobs within West Central Minnesota. We don't have the specific data on that project back yet. We do anticipate it within the month. I can say that given the harvest issues that West Central Minnesota went through, it went very smooth. We had three demonstrations tied to that that demonstration project kind of throughout the region, and the attendance for that was actually quite good. The intent is that CVAC will utilize the cobs that were collected to help in their permitting of their gasification unit to switch over from wood to corn cobs and essentially position themselves for the coming harvest of 09. The third one, Otter Tail Ag Energy, which is located in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, we've worked with them with the solubles, taking a look at could we digest thin stillage, thin and thick stillage. We actually started out with thick stillage, doing the digestion of thick stillage, and then we moved on to take a look at could we digest thin stillage. What were the technical issues dealing with that? What were the economic issues dealing with that? And that project is still in progress right now. We're finishing up the final stages of that, and hopefully that project will move forward. Now, if we take a look at the research that is currently going on and the work that we have going on dealing with the next generation of biofuels, where we have current projects going and where we are assisting is assisting them as they're developing these new products and working with them to make sure that they do meet current ASTM specifications. Much like we did with the startup on the biodiesel plants. And as Commissioner Hugeson had stated, the Central Minnesota Ethanol Co-op, they are looking at putting in the first cellulosic ethanol facility, which would be a 10-million-gallon facility co-located next to their 20-million-gallon starch fermentation facility. And we did assist in the beginning feasibility analysis as well as the engineering piece on that.
Another area of research for AURI in the next generation of biofuels deals with the nitrogen fertilization field trials up in the northwest area of the state. We're looking at prairie corngrass and switchgrass. This is a cooperative project. We're working with the Natural Resources Research Institute and the U of M. Currently, it appears that, of course, depending on the price of nitrogen and the price paid for biomass, somewhere between 30 to 60 pounds per acre of nitrogen is going to be required to maximize the levels of biomass and the profits associated with that. Of course, this is an ongoing project, and we're going to need some additional data to determine the optimal levels, but it is an exciting area that we're looking at. AURI has also done significant work on developing the expert networks necessary to support the biofuels industry. One of the ways we're doing this is convening the Renewable Energy Roundtable during the 2007 legislative session. This became part of our statutory obligation. We have met for the past 2 years, having quarterly meetings. The upcoming meeting is on February 9th at the Minnesota History Center, and hopefully some of you can attend. But our work has led to the formation of action initiatives They're outlined on your handout. They're the research, both applied and basic, public policy and awareness, a talent development-focused initiative, an industry development initiative, and an economics and financing initiative. The success of the roundtable has been certainly helped by our partners. They include the University of Minnesota, the MinSCU system, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Commerce. Out of these action initiatives have come work such as the workforce gap analysis. This was an important action item for us, as we saw that the original study was done in June of 2007. Talent development issues were one of the most pressing issues for the biofuels industry. It was highly competitive to try and find the staff necessary to run the plants. Obviously, there's been some changing dynamics within the industries, and we followed up the report in September of 2008. That study found that there definitely was a lessening of the competitiveness in the hiring arena. However, they are seeing a continued need for talent development as the first kind of generation of workers at the biofuels plants are nearing the retirement age. Additionally, the plants noted a need for increased employees in the compliance and reporting areas of their plants. The report does end on a bright note, saying that as long as we're going to have combustion engines, we're going to have liquid fuels, and hopefully biofuels will always be a part of that. So it's a good way for us to end. We are excited with the work that we've been doing and hope to continue, and we look forward to an opportunity to talk to you about the other work that AURI has done.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Paris and Mr. Sparvey. Can you, is the biofuel industry economically viable without the taxpayer subsidy and the forced consumption?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that one I would have to defer to the industry. Our focus is more on the technical research side of things than necessarily on the policy side of things.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Sparby, I guess I don't know, maybe it's outside of the scope, but I thought as a research, agriculture research entity, that would be an important question to know, is whether the things that we are researching and proposing have any economic opportunity, or if they don't. Is that just something that is not a question for the Institute at all, or just hasn't been done yet?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do, before we do any work as far as on the research side, we do a market analysis for those projects. I was referring to your question of whether or not with or without subsidies or policies in place. And that would, in my mind, would fall more in the economic realm or in economists that would be able to address that, or University of Minnesota is probably where I would channel that. But within our specific projects, if it does not make economic sense on the first flush, it's something that we would not move toward in that direction.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sparby, so that you when you do the economic analysis, you assume the subsidy structure and the mandates to use it, and that becomes a part. So the question has not really been investigated, whether or not this is a sustainable industry unless we have those things in place. Is that correct, Mike?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't possess that information or that knowledge. I apologize.
Any other questions? Not. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming and giving us a little light on AURI. Members, I want to thank all of you for getting here for the first meeting this year. It'll get it'll either get better or it'll get worse, one of the two. But before you leave, before you pack up, I want to remind you that the staff and members, that next Tuesday we will tour the Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory at the University of Minnesota, those of you who want to go. The bus will be in front of the Capitol, and we'll leave it promptly at 3 p.m. We will have you back here at the Capitol no later than 6 p.m. I think there's 11 or 12 signed up so far, so there's room if you want to go and see what we're doing over there. So with that, if there's no more questions, we will be adjourned.
So it's going to be fun. Just like that.